Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. When did the Vietnam War really end? While the Paris Peace Accords of 1973 ended direct U.S. involvement and the 1975 capture of Saigon led to the reunification of the country, some Americans remained committed to the return of prisoners of war and troops missing in action long after the last shots were fired. For decades, bitter disputes raged within the U.S. population, both about the moral correctness of the war itself and the proper way to honor and care for its American victims in the aftermath. And those arguments have affected U.S. politics, policy, and culture in surprising ways for decades. Michael J. Allen is Assistant Professor of History at Northwestern University. He explores the issue in his new book, Until the Last Man Comes Home, POWs, MIAs, and the Unending Vietnam War. Michael, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
You write, wars do not end when the shooting stops. What, though, made this particular conflict so agonizingly long as compared with the other ones that we fought?
Well, I think first and foremost, it's partly that the war itself was very long and agonizing. In contrast to many American wars, the Vietnam War dragged on for longer than any war prior to the Iraq War, and it was very contentious among Americans, particularly in its later phase. So that history created a sort of conversation among Americans, often a heated one, often a contentious one, that spilled over past the point at which the peace treaty was formally negotiated. And you know, the other part of this is that the war was lost. It was, in the minds of most Americans at least, a defeat. And that loss meant that many felt there was a sense of accountability to the dead, that somebody needed to answer for their deaths, which some saw as deaths that had been in vain.
Yeah, ultimately, this is a story of how we have used what you call the politics of loss to different ends. Will you define for us the politics of loss?
Okay, the politics of loss, as I see it, is it, and attempt to explain it in the book, is a kind of an aggrieved nationalism that views the Vietnam War as a defeat and resists efforts to paint it in positive light, that resists depictions of the war as a noble cause, as Ronald Reagan often called it. But it directs its outrage over that defeat at the federal government. And it voices of foreign policy moderation inside the federal government and elsewhere in American society, especially voices of that kind on the political left. Its militance tends to be motivated by anger rather than by confidence. And so while it is unilateralist in foreign policy arenas and it is often anti-reform, it is also at odds with certain brands of neoconservatism. In that it tends to view a new U.S. foreign policy ventures with some degree of distrust and skepticism, and it tends to view white male warriors, both in Vietnam and in other contexts, as victims or people who are potential victims. And in general, it's suspicious of elites. Mm-hmm. In many respects, I think it resembles the populism of an earlier era, but it's adapted to a kind of Cold War context in which the United States is frequently at war.
Yeah, one thing that's really interesting that you bring home in the book is the difference between the average American Vietnam POW and the population of the armed forces that were fighting the war on the ground.
Well, that's right. I think that one reason that POWs and MIAs become a very popular a symbol of American victimization in Vietnam and American defeat, ultimately, in that contest, is that they tended to be pilots and aviators, and this meant that they tended to be officers. Most of them were career officers. They tended to be a little bit older, given that many of them had completed college and other kinds of advanced training. They tended to be more settled. Most were married. Many had children. They were, in short, more like middle-class Americans than your average infantry combat soldier. And as a result of this, I think many white middle-class Americans, who often didn't have a direct link to the war because middle-class Americans tended to have more routes to avoid the war through attending college or through various kinds of deferments. It gave those middle-class Americans a kind of connection to the war, but one that was, in many respects, different from the kind of connection that was brought home in other areas of the war. You didn't see the kind of confusion and the purposeless kind of tromping around the jungles in the POW-MIA context that you saw in the nightly news coverage of the conflict.
Can you talk for a minute about how the emerging POW-MIA movement during the time of the war tended to affect the national appetite for ongoing conflict?
Well, in the context of the Vietnam War, I think in general, it eroded support for the war over many years. The POW-MIA issue emerges as a concern for most Americans around the time of Richard Nixon's election, 1968-1969. And, you know, the war drags on after that point until 1972. But increasingly, there was a sense of frustration that these men were continuing to be kept in captivity and could not be brought home. Now, sometimes that frustration led to calls to prosecute the war more harshly, and so it could also lend itself to a kind of pro-war message. But on the whole, as I attempt to show in the book, I think it led to a kind of erosion of support for the war over the long term, and the Nixon administration certainly feared that. In the years to come, I think it made many Americans, particularly in the 1970s and 80s, fearful of another kind of Vietnam War. Many could recall what had happened in Vietnam, and they recalled that in part through the POW-MIA story. And so many were fearful of wars, for instance, in Nicaragua or elsewhere that might break out that would result in further open-ended conflicts. Of course, over time, particularly after September 11th, I think that memory has been perhaps less pressing and has been displaced by more current events. And so I think that kind of cautionary memory has faded somewhat in more recent years.
Michael J. Allen is my guest. He's assistant professor of history at Northwestern University. His new book is called Until the Last Man Comes Home, POWs, MIAs, and the Unending Vietnam War. Michael, what can we say now definitively about the number of Americans held captive during the Vietnam War and the number of still missing in action when the fighting ended?
Good questions. There were, of course, varying numbers of Americans in captivity and missing during the war. Those numbers were always inching up as the war dragged on. They were added to. In general, there were some 700 Americans who were held captive at some point during the Vietnam War. That includes the roughly 590 who returned in Operation Homecoming at the very end of the war, but it also includes dozens that were held in captivity for shorter periods of time, some of whom escaped, others of whom were granted early release. At the end of the war, after Operation Homecoming, there are about 2,500 Americans who remain in either captive and missing status or missing status who are presumed to be dead. These are called BNR, which stands for Killed in Action, Body Not Recovered. But this population of 2,500 that exists at the end of the war is gradually whittled down through body recovery efforts and remains repatriation efforts in the post-war period to the point where right now, at present, there are 1,731 Americans in missing status. And, you know, those numbers continue to fall very slowly each year through ongoing recovery efforts.
We should stop here and get some history about the ethos of leave no man behind, because this was an idea that many people really treasured, but it wasn't always practiced to the degree that it was in Vietnam.
Well, that's right. And that was really the question that got me started on this project as a dissertation when I was in graduate school. I was just curious why it was that the United States was going to such lengths to recover this population of about 2,500 after the Vietnam War, when compared to earlier conflicts, those numbers were relatively small. I was doing research at the time on Korean War POWs, and I learned through that research that there were 8,000 Americans still missing from the Korean War. And, you know, subsequent research told me that there are 78,000 missing from World War II. There were, you know, almost 170,000 missing from the Civil War, and that's just federal troops. So I wondered, what was it about the Vietnam War that caused this pursuit of these men to go to such lengths? And, you know, the project grew from there. But in answer to your question, this idea that it's part of a long American tradition to leave no man behind really isn't borne out by the historical record. I would add that there always have been efforts on the part of the U.S. government and on the part of American citizens to recover the missing. It's certainly not new to the Vietnam War that there are efforts to recover the missing, but those efforts have never been as lengthy or as contentious as they were after the Vietnam War. And I think the numbers still missing from earlier conflicts testify to that.
Yeah, it's really remarkable that you write that some very prominent people at the conclusion of World War I said it's not really practical to recover a lot of these fallen soldiers and we should bury them where they lay, including people as high up in the government as Teddy Roosevelt.
Yes, Teddy Roosevelt was no longer president at the time, but he was still a very prominent figure in American politics in the World War I era, and his son had died in World War I. And Roosevelt advocated that Americans who were missing and who had died in World War I fighting in Western Europe be buried in Western Europe. For Roosevelt, who was a staunch nationalist and a strong proponent of sort of military courage and military honor, this burial in Europe was a sort of sign of respect for not just the American war dead, but also for the American, British and American-French alliance and kind of the American Anglo ties that crossed the Atlantic. But this idea that the dead would be buried in Europe was very disturbing to many families of the dead, many families of the missing, and also to some organized efforts, including on the part of embalmers and morticians who hoped to see the dead brought back to the United States so that they could be buried either in national cemeteries inside the United States or in private graveyards. And so in the end, while there are thousands of American war dead from World War I buried in Europe, the majority of American families choose, and they are given the choice, to bring their loved ones home for burial inside the United States.
Yeah, and in fact, you write about the first real POW activist in U.S. history was the mother of a lost soldier who simply could not accept that her son was dead.
Well, the first that we know about, I mean, I can certainly imagine that there are hundreds, maybe thousands of loved ones from the Civil War, from subsequent wars, who wonder what happened to their loved one and persist in the belief that their loved one still may be alive somewhere out there without a body to confirm that they're dead. But the first MIA activist we know about is a woman, Maria Stinchcomb, I believe is her name, whose son was shot down over Eastern Europe and who continues to search for him. This is in World War II, continues to search for him for years and persists in the belief that he is held in a Soviet prison deep into the Cold War.
My guest is Michael J. Allen, Assistant Professor of History at Northwestern University. His new book is called Until the Last Man Comes Home, POWs, MIAs, and the Unending Vietnam War. You can join the conversation now by calling us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Michael J. Allen, Assistant Professor of History at Northwestern University. His new book is called Until the Last Man Comes Home, POWs, MIAs, and the Unending Vietnam War. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Michael, how did the POW-MIA movement begin to organize itself during the Vietnam War?
Well, this is one of the points of controversy that exists around POW-MIA history. The traditional argument among POW-MIA families has been that they organized themselves because they wanted answers from the U.S. government, and they wanted to put pressure on the Vietnamese communists about what was happening to their men over in Vietnam. Many scholars who have looked at this issue over the years have argued, well, really, there was more organized efforts on the part of the Nixon administration, which took office in 1968, to help bring these folks together, that Nixon and his defense secretary, Melvin Laird, played the leading role in kind of orchestrating what was in some ways a kind of fake grassroots movement to put pressure on the Vietnamese and also to try to rally support behind a war effort that they continued to prosecute. Now, I show that there's some merit to both of these ideas, that in fact there were cells of organized POW-MIA families who were coming together around military bases, particularly in Southern California, around Sybil Stockdale, who was the wife of future Admiral Jim Stockdale, one of the senior-ranking POWs in Hanoi, that these cells started to come together and organize kind of as mutual support networks in 1966, 1967, quite a long time before Nixon becomes president. But it's only really with the assistance of Nixon and Melvin Laird that these groups are able to be knitted together into a nationwide network, and that for some time early in Nixon's administration, the POW-MIA families tended to be quite supportive of his policies in Vietnam, but that by 1971 and certainly by 1972, some of the leading POW-MIA family members had broken with Nixon and began to criticize his war policies, because they feel that all Nixon is doing is perpetuating the war that keeps their men in captivity, and many of them want to get their men home. However, even then, even late in the war, that was still a minority position, and by and large, POW-MIA families remain supportive of Nixon all the way to 1973.
And the perspective of the Nixon administration was essentially that highlighting the plight of these individuals would give people a reason to continue fighting their Vietnamese torturers.
That's right. There's two essential ideas for people inside the Nixon administration. One is that the plight of the POWs who are being held in pretty brutal conditions illustrates what they see as the kind of depravity of the enemy, that the Vietnamese communist enemy really is not peaceful, not peace-loving, not nationalistic even, but really just evil. And by highlighting the condition of the POWs, Nixon can convince Americans that they are facing an implacable foe, and the responsibility for the war and its continuation lies in Hanoi, not in Washington. So that's one reason that Nixon highlights the POWs. The other reason, and this is increasingly the case he makes as the war drags on, is that only by continuing to fight the war can Americans guarantee that all the POWs will be brought back. The administration begins to make the argument that some Americans may be held in a kind of secret captivity, that Americans may not know the full extent of American servicemen who are in a Vietnamese captivity. And so if Americans were to negotiate a withdrawal and withdraw prematurely, as he sees it, then we'll never know if the Vietnamese are going to return everyone that they truly hold. And this really is the genesis of the whole notion that Americans remain inside Vietnam after the war ends. Richard Nixon regularly would make claims to the effect that 1,600 Americans were being held in Vietnamese captivity, a number that really no U.S. intelligence supported at the time. What he was doing was he was conflating those known to be in captivity with those who were simply missing without evidence of their death. Now, most of those men, because they were pilots who'd been shot down, likely were dead, but there wasn't proof that they were dead, and so Nixon could claim that they were in captivity. And so when only 590 come home in 1973, many are left wondering, well, what happened to the rest of the American men that we've been hearing about?
And for decades, we have had sporadic reports that there is evidence that, in fact, there are still Americans, to this day, still American POWs alive and in captivity in Vietnam.
That's right. And, you know, how convincing you find that evidence really depends, I think, mainly on your sort of pre-existing notions about this whole subject. But some of that evidence comes from Vietnamese refugees who flee South Vietnam. And sometimes flee North Vietnam in the late 1970s. Many refugees believed that by giving evidence of Americans in captivity, by saying that they'd seen Americans in captivity, that they might gain an advantage in gaining entry into the United States. Remember that there were tens of thousands of Vietnamese refugees in the late 1970s seeking entry into the United States, and some believed that this would help them get entry to the United States. And so that's the source of some evidence. There's also purported satellite imagery that might show POW camps, even shadows of people that seem too tall to be Vietnamese. This is the kind of evidence that some POW MIA activists will cite as proof of captivity. You know, a lot of this has to do with the difficulty of proving death. Really, the only way to prove that the MIAs are not captive, that they are dead, is to find their remains. And because many of these men were pilots who were shot down at very high rates of speed in violent conditions, often in very forbidding natural environments, it's really hard to find remains. And unless you can provide remains, there's really no way you can prove that a missing man is dead. And so there's always the ability to hold out hope that maybe those maybe some of those men at least continue to be alive. And people that want to believe that can find evidence, generally speaking, can find evidence that will help them support that belief.
So in 1979, we have the reemergence of this guy, Robert Garwood, who has been a prisoner in Vietnam. But his story was not as straightforward as people within the movement would have liked. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
Yeah, well, Robert Garwood is really the lone American that we know about with certainty who remained inside Vietnam after the Paris Peace Agreement and after the withdrawal of all U.S. Forces and all U.S. personnel in 1975. Garwood returns in 1979, and he had been a POW. He had been captive for 13 years, or at least he'd been in Vietnam for 13 years. But the problem with Robert Garwood, who would seem to be proof that MIA survival was possible and would therefore seem to be a kind of welcome development among POW MIA activists, is that Robert Garwood was widely despised by his fellow POWs. Garwood was essentially somebody who had gone over to the other side. He may have deserted. It's unclear exactly how he fell into Vietnamese custody. But after becoming captive, Garwood learns Vietnamese, and he gradually becomes a kind of collaborator with the Vietnamese. He engages in guarding other Americans. He speaks regularly with his Vietnamese guards. He gets special rations from his Vietnamese guards. And eventually, he is let go, and he makes his way into North Vietnam, and he sort of resides not so much as a prisoner, but as a kind of ward of the state, if you will, in North Vietnam. And then when he decides he wants to return to the United States, he is able to make contact with some Europeans who are in Hanoi, and he lets them know that he's there, and that allows for arrangements to be made that bring him home. After returning to the United States, he's court-martialed for striking a fellow prisoner, and eventually he has his rank reduced, he's dishonorably discharged, and he forfeits some of his pay that he was owed due to his time in Vietnam. But Garwood also makes allegations after returning that he wasn't alone in Vietnam, that he saw other Americans in Vietnam while he was there. Whether or not he is a reliable witness is one of the things that people argue about a lot in POWMI circles. But clearly from his story, he wasn't the kind of returning hero that many POWMI activists had hoped for.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Michael J. Allen is my guest. We're talking about his new book, Until the Last Man Comes Home, POWs, MIAs, and the Unending Vietnam War. Let's go on the phones to Patrick in Richardson. Hello, Patrick.
Hello. Just want to tell you I love the show, and the subject matter today is just really close to my heart. I wanted to ask the author if he can speak to the story of Bo Gritz and the legendary or 52 symbol on the ground that American military agencies picked up and extrapolated into possibly being a sign from downed American pilots, and just the coalescing of all these stories into, like, how are we supposed to think when people from former units believe in this and they're educated and they're down-to-earth operators that don't tend to make snap judgments, and they're disappointed in the fact that we never helped our MIAs. I'll take my question off the air. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks for your call.
Well, thank you for the question. James Bo Gritz was a former Special Forces officer. I believe his rank was Lieutenant Colonel. He was he retired after the war, but he led a foray into Laos in 1982, I believe it was, in search of confirmation that there were perhaps still American POWs being held by communist forces in Laos. And he claimed to have support from the Reagan administration for his effort. And in my book, I show that he did indeed get some funding and equipment from Army intelligence units at the time to pursue this mission, though the White House and President Ronald Reagan attempted to keep him at arm's length and disavowed a formal responsibility for authorizing his mission. But the larger question the caller raises is, well, if somebody like Bo Gritz, who is a decorated Vietnam veteran, believes that Americans might be held in captivity in Vietnam, shouldn't American citizens also possibly believe this idea, or doesn't that give credence to the idea? And, perhaps. What I would say to this is that Bo Gritz, is one figure who has been very publicly identified with this, but he represents a lot of Vietnam veterans who suspect that Americans might be POWs, might be held in captivity in Vietnam. But he was never in any specific kind of position to have detailed intelligence on the likelihood of this. In other words, the very fact that he was a Vietnam veteran did not mean that he was an expert on the likelihood of American survival in captivity. And there's always the possibility that somebody may have been kept behind. And like I said before, one of the difficulties here is proving a negative. How do you prove someone is dead in the absence of remains? But, I would add that though Bo Gritz was considered a hero in the early 1980s, he is also a bit of an unstable figure. He later goes on to join the militia movement. He runs for president as a kind of a far-right conservative figure and later attempts suicide by shooting himself and fails to succeed. That's not to cast aspersions on him. It's simply to say that, there are lots of Vietnam veterans who are in various ways troubled by the outcome of the Vietnam War and who find in the POW MIA issue a way of attempting to correct what they see as the failures of the Vietnam War. I think what Bo Greitz found attractive about the issue was that he could feel he was doing something to rectify a war that really deeply troubled him, and he could take direct action on behalf of Americans who he felt had been victimized by U.S. policy in Vietnam. I can sympathize with that idea without necessarily endorsing his view that POWs remain in captivity in Vietnam.
Of course, a lot of people have made the connection that Bo Greitz might have been the inspiration for the fictionalized character of Rambo, played by Sylvester Stallone. Did those movies and did sort of pop culture visions of what might be happening and have happened tend to color people's opinions of the actual truth?
I certainly think so. This is one of the main ways that the story of Greitz and others like him were circulated in the early to mid-1980s. Greitz got funding in part from Clint Eastwood and William Shatner, who purchased the rights to his story to develop as a future movie idea. And, you know, he was the inspiration behind a lot of the, not just Rambo, but the Chuck Norris MIA series and also the Gene Hackman character in Uncommon Valor. All of these stories revolve around a kind of retired Special Forces mid-career officer who is disgusted with the war and decides to go back and kind of finish what they were never able to finish while actually fighting the Vietnam War, just sort of restore a successful outcome to the war. And that idea was very attractive, not just to veterans, but to Americans in general in the 1970s and 1980s. And going to these movies not only sort of familiarized Americans with this story and all of its details, but also gave them the cathartic sense that they were somehow reversing this national defeat that they felt traumatized by or troubled by in the 1980s.
Michael J. Allen is my guest. He's assistant professor of history at Northwestern. His new book is called Until the Last Man Comes Home, POWs, MIAs, and the Unending Vietnam War. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Michael J. Allen, whose new book is called Until the Last Man Comes Home, POWs, MIAs, and the Unending Vietnam War. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. Michael, you illustrate a really fascinating dimension of this story and its odd alliances and adversaries. When you talk about Senators John Kerry and John McCain regarding Vietnam, both were veterans. They emerged from their service with very different conclusions about the war itself and then ultimately ended up on the same page regarding the normalization of U.S. relations with Vietnam.
That's right. You know, and this, I think, illustrates in general the strange bedfellows that you find throughout this story, where critics of the war on the right and the left sometimes come together for various reasons and end up aligning themselves in striking and unusual ways. But Kerry and McCain had regarded each other with some suspicion as junior senators throughout their the late 80s. And when the Senate Select Committee on POW/MIAs is formed in 1991, they become strange kind of teammates as the two most widely known and sort of most widely respected veterans on this committee and as members of two separate parties. They sort of join together in opposition to the National League of POW/MIA Families and many POW/MIA activists who had been saying the United States cannot normalize relations with the Socialist Republic of Vietnam because we do not have all the answers about American POWs and MIAs. And until Vietnam is more forthcoming with remains and with other kinds of evidence that there are no Americans in captivity, then the United States should continue to place an embargo on Vietnam and refuse to have any diplomatic dealings with Vietnam. But Kerry and McCain, I think both for different reasons, found the POW-MIA movement troubling. McCain was troubled by the fact that he himself was, of course, a returned POW, and one of the things that the POWs had devoted a lot of energy to was making sure that, while they were in captivity, was making sure that they knew all the Americans in captivity. They memorized names, and they went to great lengths to know who was in the captivity system so that when they came back, they could say, yes, we knew these people were in captivity, and yes, they came home. And so McCain, I think, was troubled by the idea that the MIA activists were saying that there were more men left behind, and McCain wasn't being honest about their return. He was also troubled by the fact that MIA activists continued to remind Americans that the Vietnam War was a traumatic and kind of dishonorable affair, whereas McCain believed that it was a noble cause, in part because his father, as the chief naval officer of Pacific Forces, was responsible for helping to wage that war. Kerry, on the other hand, I feel was troubled by the POW-MIA movement's kind of right-wing politics and the fact that the POW-MIA movement was very vocal in accusing him and other anti-war activists of having abandoned and betrayed American soldiers. So for very different reasons and very different assessments of the war, these two men come together in opposition to the POW-MIA movement. And their argument is the only way that Americans will ever get answers about MIAs is by cooperating with Vietnam. And they use that argument to advance normalization of relations. They begin a kind of fact-finding effort that has joint recovery efforts in which Vietnamese and American forces go out into the field in search of American remains. And through that process, they're able to deliver an increasing number of American remains. And they're able to show progress, in other words, on the accounting front. And they argue, only through continued cooperation can we continue this progress. And so that begins the process of normalization that ultimately culminates in normalization of diplomatic relations in 1995.
And in fact, has there been a measurable improvement in the ability to recover remains that are still missing?
There certainly was in the 1990s. You know, the 1990s see some of the peak years in terms of remains repatriation. And that's in part because the Vietnamese are attempting to do all they can to supply answers and remains and information during that time in hopes of normalizing relations. In the more recent years, the George W. Bush administration and on into the present, progress has slowed somewhat simply because all of the easy cases, all of the readily recoverable cases have now been found. And so as you go further and further into this process, it becomes increasingly difficult to find remains and to deliver answers on figures that haven't already been accounted for. But yes, I mean, in comparison to the 1980s, which saw relatively little progress, particularly in the early 1980s, the 1990s see enhanced remains repatriation. I guess I would add here, though, is that what POW-MIA activists would say in answer to what I've just said is that, yeah, what they've delivered is remains. They have not delivered any live POWs. We don't care about remains. The argument goes, what we really care about are live prisoners. But, of course, the answer to that is, if there are no live prisoners to be returned, then how can you expect Vietnam to supply those? And so it becomes a kind of catch-22. I mean, you can always accuse both the U.S. government and the Vietnamese government of not doing enough. If your standard is the return of a live American, it's very unlikely that that standard will ever be met because there's very little evidence, particularly at this point, at this late date, that any Americans remain in custody.
For people who believe that there are live prisoners still in captivity, given our normalized relations with Vietnam, what would the motivation, what would they understand the motivation to be for keeping those live prisoners as opposed to turning them over?
This has always been the question that is asked of POW MIA activists. What is the motivation? Generally speaking, those activists will answer the motivation is to extort things from the United States. The most frequently cited goal is that Vietnam wishes to get reconstruction aid, reparations that the United States promised as part of the Paris Peace Agreement. But the problem with this argument is that in order to accomplish that goal, Vietnam would actually have to say, we have an American prisoner and we will give him to the United States only if we get billions of dollars in reconstruction aid. And while Vietnam has insisted throughout its history that the U.S. is still obligated to provide them with reconstruction aid under the Paris Agreement, they have never attempted to bargain with American POWs in this way after the war. They've never said, we have this American, we will return him for money, or we will return him for favors or anything of that nature. Vietnam has been, I think, very dogged in pursuit of the things that it feels it was promised in the Paris Peace Agreement, but it has never made that direct connection. And so the motivation has always been really sort of lacking here, in particular when you think about the history. The history is that the United States, largely at the behest of POW/MIA families and activists, refused to not only recognize Vietnam, but refused to have any economic trade or activity with Vietnam throughout the 1970s, throughout the 1980s, and throughout much of the 1990s until 1994. And so not only did Vietnam not get anything out of the POW issue, in fact, it was very severely punished and harmed through accusations of holding American POWs. So it strikes me as a real problem for POW/MIA activists in explaining what would motivate the Vietnamese to continue to hold these men. At the end of the day, the claims really rest on the idea that Vietnamese are simply bad people, or at least their government is bad, that they would hold these men simply because they are malicious or because they are evil. That is really the kind of underlying assumption behind these arguments.
Let's go back to the phones now, and this time we will speak with Matthew in Dallas. Hello, Matthew.
Hi. Michael, I have a question for you. I was wondering if you're familiar with the story of Army Colonel Jim Thompson, and if you are, if you could maybe give us a little insight into his experience as a POW, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Yes. Jim Thompson is the longest-held American POW in the Vietnam War. Sometimes Everett Alvarez is credited with that distinction. Alvarez is the longest-held American POW in North Vietnam. But Thompson was shot down, I believe, in a helicopter a few months before Alvarez. This is in 1964, and he's held throughout the remainder of the war. There were some American POWs before Thompson, but they were released prior to the end of the war. So Thompson enjoys the distinction of being the longest-held American POW and is kind of bitter upon returning to the United States that he is not celebrated as such, that instead, generally speaking, people will think that Everett Alvarez is the longest-held POW. But I talk a little bit about Thompson in the book as an example of the troubles that many American POWs have upon returning to the United States. Thompson was very badly wounded when he was shot down, and he was held in South Vietnamese captivity in jungle prison camps. He was often moved around. He suffered from a lot of disease and very poor nutrition and medical treatment while he was in captivity in South Vietnam. He really went through a terrible ordeal. And when he came home, he was scarred by that experience, both physically and emotionally. His wife had begun an affair with another man while he was in captivity. He and her are unable to reconcile. He's never really known his children during that time, and he and his wife get divorced, and he goes through a very difficult experience. And while his experience was maybe unusually difficult, what I found is actually many of the returnees, even though they're very proud of their service and are very proud of the fact that they remained loyal, patriotic Americans throughout this ordeal, are quite angry and upset and traumatized upon returning to the United States and finding the degree of anti-war sentiment that they do, finding that the civil rights and the feminist movements have accomplished significant changes, many of which they don't necessarily agree with upon their return. And so they're estranged from their country and from Americans to a certain degree that leaves them angry and often at odds with their fellow citizens. I think one reason that John McCain has been the most successful and accomplished of all of the returnees is that in many respects he seems sort of least scarred by his experience, whereas many of these men are quite shattered as a result of their ordeal.
Michael, what are the outcomes of the 2004 and 2008 presidential campaigns in which a major party in each one had a Vietnam veteran run and be defeated? What does that tell you about the way, the importance we now attach to Vietnam in terms of as something that matters as we move forward?
Well, I mean, it is striking, and it's not just 2004 and 8, but McCain also runs in 2000, and
sure.
So our recent presidential cycles have been very much shaped by not just the Vietnam War, but by the POW-MIA issue in particular. And I think that it speaks to, one, just the generational fact that men who served in Vietnam are now sort of in advanced age and getting to the point where they tend to play a prominent part in American politics. But more importantly, I think it suggests the deep passions that the Vietnam War still ignites. I think most Americans were quite surprised to find that John Kerry was so viciously attacked by many other Vietnam veterans, by the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth, who later became the Swift Vets and POWs for Truth, and may have also been a little bit surprised that John McCain wasn't able to turn his POW war record into wasn't able to sort of capitalize on it quite as much as maybe some expected. But in part, both men suffered from the kind of deep ambivalence Americans have about Vietnam. John Kerry hoped to sort of turn his Vietnam experience into a cautionary tale for Americans. And many Americans said, well, who are you to tell us about the Vietnam War? I've learned about that through other means, in part through the POW story. John McCain hoped to make it a kind of heroic tale, and many Americans didn't buy that either. So I think Americans have this kind of intense connection to the Vietnam War that makes it difficult for Vietnam veterans, actually.
Michael J. Allen's new
presidential politics.
New book is called Until the Last Man Comes Home. Michael, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you, Chris. Thanks for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.